You're listening to the Drummers Education Connection Podcast. Interviews with the greatest drummers in the business and roundtable discussions with industry leaders and teachers from around the globe to help provide performance, insight, and inspiration.
There we are. We are live. Hello, everybody. That was awesome. I'm Mark Robley.
Wow.
And you are on Drummers Education Connection. I'm here with Jeremy's not with us today. We got two of my great, well, actually three of my great friends with me today. Rick Stojak down in the San Diego area, Chip Ritter out in Tucson, and one of the nicest guys you ever want to meet in the music business, Stevie D, is our guest today.
Stevie D.
How you doing, buddy?
Good.
Good. Hey, real quick before we get, it's great to see you. Before we get started with Stevie's interview, we're going to do what we always do, take care of a little business here. If you want to contribute to us on Patreon, you can. Go find
us
on there.
The chat.
Yep. There'll be a link also on the YouTube. And we help us keep the lights on, pay for our streaming and stuff like that. And then we're going to do our good things where we just talk about some stuff that we all have personally going on. Today, I'm going to throw it to Chip. Chip, what do you got going on that's good, buddy?
Man, what's good in my life right now is I'm practicing an hour a day for a recommitment to being the best drummer I can be. And I'm going through some stuff that I've always wanted to work on. And I'm zoning out and doing my things, kind of like surfing. And I'm having a great time getting ready for a couple shows coming up on the 24th and the 30th with Lisa Ote and the Desert Divas in Tucson. So that's pretty good for me. How are you doing, Rick?
I am great, Chip. It sounds exciting. I'm glad to hear that you are back practicing, and that's super exciting. It's hard to imagine you getting better because you're already so damn good, as everyone agrees.
Man, whatever.
So, but that's a great thing, man. So my good thing is, you know, rock and roll is the family business. My sister-in-law, Laura Christine, has officially joined her partner, Gene Hoagland, in the band Dark Angel. So awesome. They are bringing extreme metal, thrash metal, way, way back to the masses. And so it's super exciting. They're playing festivals in Chile. They just did three sold-out shows in L.A. over the weekend. And so it's just super exciting. I'm just so proud of my sister-in-law, Laura Christine. She's the most ripping heavy metal shredder, and she's on the big stage. So.
Wow. Right on.
Congratulations, Laura. Yep.
Good for her. It's cool. Good for her. That's awesome.
What's up with you, Bart?
You know, I got a couple of things going on. I'm doing some producing. I have a brand new song that's just about ready to come out. We're going to fly in a couple more tracks this week. And that's with my side project, The Ruins, waiting on some harp tracks to come in on that. It's kind of a bluesy tune, an old, like an old Muddy Waters tune. It's not something that you would expect from us. So it's been a lot of fun with Todd McTavish singing on that. And then just as usual, you know, out there on the road with Sam Morrison Band and doing our thing. So that's what we got good going on. But today, what's really good is again Stevie D. For those
Stevie
of you who
D's
don't know Stevie,
house.
He's played with everybody from David Gilmour, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Don Felder, Kenny Loggins, Joe Walsh, Chris Robinson. The list goes on and on and on. He's an amazing singer, an amazing drummer, an amazing producer, and it's our pleasure to have him on. Stevie, how are you, bud?
Oh, great. Thanks so much for having me today.
Oh, you bet.
Yeah.
You bet. We've been working on it for a while, trying to get you on the show, and it's really nice to have you on here. So with all those names, for those of you who haven't seen it on my YouTube channel, you can go to my YouTube channel, and there's a three-part video on there that I did with Stevie a number of years ago, kind of talking about some of the stuff that we're going to talk about today. Talk to us about how you got started in the music business as a drummer, and how you went on to play for these legendary people. Like, where did you start out? What was your first kind of, you know, get going moment?
Well, kind of probably similar to many drummers. From my mom told me that I was banging on pots and pans when I was just a little kid. I'd get them out at like probably 4 or 5 years old. And then I saw Parade that my brother and a local friend was in, and I must have been 6 years old. And I just remember the drums going by and through my chest, and that was it. I was like, I'm marching around the house and my pajamas on. And so I got a toy drum set for Christmas. It was like a go-go, and my sister got the boots and I got the little drum set, and I tore through that thing in one sitting. And then I think I got, you know, I just got the bug at a really young age. And I don't know if you guys know this drummer. His name is John Ferraro, but he's played with John. I owe John a lot because John was a buddy of my brother's and I wanted to be John. He was great back when he was like in junior high school. So he kind of took me under his wing and I took lessons from him, and but he wouldn't really let me play on the drum set. He made me play on a practice pad probably for 4 years. And
wow.
But I, you know, as a kid, all you want to do is get on the drums and bash around and it just looks so cool. And that's all you want to do. And I remember he had egg cartons on his wall that to soundproof it with like an American flag and just a psychedelic room. And he was like the coolest dude I ever met, you know? So that's kind of where I started out. And then I took lessons, you know, Roy Burns' elementary drum book, and he tried to get me through that. And I had the attention span of a slug. So, you know, as a kid, you're just, like I said, all you want to do is get on that drums. But the good thing was the fact that I wasn't allowed. I kept telling my dad, you know, don't buy Steve a drum set yet. He's not ready. So I was just like, you know, I want a drum set every year. Please, I want a drum set. So as I got older, you know, there would be kids in the neighborhood that actually had drums that didn't even know. They got it for Christmas or whatever. So I'd, can I play your drum set? And so I'd play them. And it's funny, things just kind of evolved naturally. Like it just, there was no thought involved. Like in fourth grade, we had a assembly where the whole school shows up, right? And there was a woman named Norma Butcher who had a school called Perkins School of Music. And her son was a fantastic piano player. Well, she brought all the instruments. She had the trumpet and the sax and the piano, and there was a drum set. And, you know, there's first through sixth grade in this assembly. And she gets to the drum set and she says, I hear we have a drummer in the audience. And this is fourth grade. She said, could little Steve DeStanislaw come up and demonstrate the drum? Now, I don't know how she even knew I played the drums. And I went up there and the whole place clapped, and I did, you know, my version of trying to play a drum solo. And I get down from after the assembly, this teacher comes up to me. Hey man, I'm Chuck. I'm going to be your teacher next year. I play guitar. Do you want to jam? Can you imagine that?
Right on.
Can you imagine that happening today? So Chuck, he played guitar and he was going to be my teacher the next year. He knew I was going to be a student. And finally that Christmas, I got my first drum set, which was John, my brother, and my dad went around Newport Beach area and, you know, looking at used drums. And John was like, no, Mr. DeStanislaw, I don't think this is a good set. I wouldn't buy this. And so they finally found a set at a pawn shop, and it was a Ludwig 12, 16 or 14 and a Superphonic snare with one Japanese cymbal and actually Ace Zildjian's hi-hats that I still have. And
cool.
I was in heaven. I got that drum set and I sat down on that thing. And I, you know, just like we all do, you know, we all have that. It hits us, you know. But the good thing was I really wanted it. You know, I had to really work for it. It wasn't like, but, you know, you want to play drums, buy them a 10-piece DW. Well, they didn't have DW back then, but you know what I'm saying. So it was great because I really wanted it, you know. It made me really want that. So I kind of kept taking lessons. Now I started a band with my teacher, and we called it Sundance. I had business cards made. I was 10, and we were doing gigs. We were booking the Girl Scout house and the Lido Clubhouse, and we played the dances, and I was singing lead in the band and playing. And I remember playing, we played 25 or 6-4, and I couldn't do the boo da and the bass drum. So I would go da 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 da. So those were my earliest recollection of playing. I mean, and it just kind of continued. Then I got in the junior high band and junior high big band freshman year in high school, I kind of quit. I put the drums in the closet, and I was a freshman now, and I got new friends, and we're going to bird dog. We're going to go chase girls and stuff. And then, so the sophomore year, I decided I'm going to get serious about it. I was kind of like, I think I want to do this. So I found a teacher at West Coast Drum Center named Richard Neild, who taught me a ton. That guy, I watched the David Garibaldi episode you guys had, which was fabulous. Yeah. And I'll talk more about David later, because I studied with him for a minute later in my years. But Richard was similar thing. He basically, you know, he would get very angry if I wouldn't work on my lesson. And he was very like, hey, quit wasting my time. You're wasting, you know, if I didn't get it together, you know. So that was really good. He was really disciplinarian. And he taught me how to play a little piano and chords. And he had me play. He played piano. But he took me through, what was it, the Advanced Techniques for Modern, Advanced Techniques book, the four-way thing, stick control. And the biggest one, I have to say, was syncopation. Because he took me through that like 5-6 ways. I know it's a very simple book, but it really like helped me. And although I was had a real, I think where my gift came in was my ear. I think because it took me forever to figure out how to read. I wasn't like, it really took, I mean, I was natural in that sense musically. Like I could hear really well and listen to, I could really, my ear is great. But to be honest with you, I really had to work hard to get through those books. And the academic part of it. And so I had to really work hard for that. So I owe him a lot for that. I worked for him through my senior year. And then after that, my senior year, the jazz band kind of fell apart. The high school band kind of fell apart. So I ended up going to OCC, Orange Coast College, and playing in the Friday band. And then I played there. And then I went to Chaffey College and played there. And then by that time, it was 19, I started doing sessions earlier than that. Like there was a guy named Phil Marshall who used to hire John Ferraro. And John got the gig with Larry Carlton. So John's like, I got the student, hire him. So one thing about the Orange County Newport Beach area is a ton of great players. So there was I was always playing with older players that were really good. And I just jumped in and just, okay, I'm doing this. So I was like 17, 18 years old doing like Carl's Jr. commercials and stuff, you know, because of Phil. And, you know, I was a good enough reader. I could read the charts, but it wasn't like, you know, note for note, you know, I would never have made it in Frank Zappa's band, you know, put it that way. So, anyway, that's kind of how it all started out. And then by the time I was 19, I was playing with Nia Peoples. She was an actress. She had a band and we were doing gigs. So I remember my 19th birthday, we did a gig at the Bonaventure Hotel. That was I remember that gig. And then 20 years old, I threw some other events. It's just, you know, this is how the business works. It's like you show up and you meet somebody and they remember you and they go, hey, this guy'd be good. And that's kind of how it all kind of went, you know? It wasn't it wasn't a concerted effort. I'm going to do this and then I'm going to do this. It was just like, show up, do this, meet that person. So I remember I did a recording. James Raymond and I wrote a tune and we went out and recorded it. We hired this guitar player. We wrote this tune called Marlene. It was very Toto-ish, I think, you know. And the guitar player, Mike Hodge, said, hey, we're playing at, you live in Newport, we're playing at the Registry Hotel, our last gig Saturday night. And I remember being on the couch at home and I go, oh, that's right, that band's playing tonight. So I drove down there. It was like a midnight. I walk in, there's like nobody in the club. Hey, Steve, come on, sit in. Sat in. Afterward, the keyboard player goes, give me your number. 6 months later, he calls me up and says, I'm putting a band together to go to Tokyo Disneyland. Do you want to do it with me? I said, sure. So we got the gig, went to Tokyo Disneyland. I was 20, worked over there for 6 months. We did 7 shows a day, 5 days a week. Oh, came home from that, worked at Disney Park here. And then I went on tour with this woman named Maria Conchita Alonso, who was like a Venezuelan soap star. And again, word of mouth. They had a band called Zot that was on her label. The drummer didn't want to do it. He was a great player. And they heard about me and, hey, you want to do this tour of South America? Sure, did that. And then one thing led to another, just tons of gigs, man, you know? And then same thing with Anka, you know, my friend, I was in Long Beach, tons of great players in Long Beach. I was in a basketball league. We talked about this.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, Andy Martin calls me up. He was a first call trombone player in LA now. I mean, he's ridiculously good. He and Wayne Bergeron. hey, we need a drummer for Paul Anka. The drummer left. Who's Paul Anka? Oh, okay. So I said, I don't know about that. You know, so he sends me the charts. I ended up going over there, auditioning, got the gig. Was with Paul 5 years. So that's what I'm talking. It was just like one thing led to another,
right.
Just kind of, you know, being in the scene and playing. And that's basically how it went, man. I mean,
on the Anka gig, on the video that you and I did on that interview, you talked about how you learned how to shape a groove. And if memory serves me correct, you were talking about, I think you said playing a bossa nova groove, and you talked about how you learned how to shape a groove working with him. And so I think we're always learning as musicians. And I think you get on a gig like that. Talk to us a little bit about that, about how you learned how to shape a groove because of Paul Anka. I always thought that was a real interesting story.
Yeah. So one great thing about Paul Anka's band, or his book, is that he had several arrangers over the years. Like, he wanted to keep his show fresh, so he'd hire different arrangers to put together his charts. So there wouldn't be just one arrangement. There'd be like four or five arrangements. So that kept you on your toes. But one thing Paul was really great at was shaping dynamics. He was really a stickler on dynamics. So, you know, if you're going to play soft, you bring it way down, and then you build it. And I was talking about that bossa because it was like it sounds very simple, but at least for me, it was difficult because it was a mid-tempo, just really soft, underscoring he was talking to the crowd, and he'd do a whole vamp, and then we'd build it up and bring it back down, build it up, and then the tune would blossom, and then it would take off. But he was really a stickler about that. And it was great. It was like the whole band has moved as one thing. And that taught me a lot, you know? I think, as you guys know, practicing and learning your fundamentals and rudiments and all that stuff is like learning a vocabulary. And the more you know about that stuff, you have a wider vocabulary to choose from when you're playing. But then when you get on the bandstand, it's almost like playing basketball or tennis or something, or surfing. You learn the fundamentals of it, and then you forget it when you're doing it. Now you're just reacting to the music and the players, and you're not thinking about every little thing you're doing. You're just, your antennas go up and you're like, okay, what's happening here? And that's, I think that's the greatest thing, because once you start developing that as a player, every situation you move into, I think it affords you to really understand the music. Listen. And David was talking about this on your other podcast, listening. That's 98% of it. Listening, listening to the other players. And that's one thing I've been told over the years. It's like, man, you're like clairvoyant. Like, you know exactly. No, I'm paying attention, and my head's going like this, and I don't even know I'm doing it, because I'm listening to everybody instead of just putting my head down. So that kind of teaches you that. And also watching a conductor. That you got to be aware. And the other thing is, a lot of these artists like Paul and Kenny Loggins, they'd go out in the audience. So you got to watch their cues out when they're way out in the audience, as well as the conductor. So you got to watch both, and there's a slight delay. So you kind of start figuring out where that's going to land too. You know what I mean? Like, and that trained me for Kenny's gig, because Kenny did that a lot. He went out in the audience, and you know, he's giving cues out there. So those are all those things that kind of added up as far as the learning throughout the every kind of situation kind of prepared you for the next one almost.
Yes.
You know what's so fantastic, Stevie, you're talking about like when we're on the band stage, we're just playing and it's just natural.
Yes.
And I think often drummers might look at that and say, look, that person's just in the zone.
Yes.
Or it's just coming easy to them. But yes, we are in the zone when we're on the stage, but the backstory behind that, look at all these lessons that you took, right? Those are all becoming part of you. And
that's
then you had access to it. And so it's the biggest testimonial ever to start really learning the instrument and really, really knowing it. Because that stuff just is, I know it's magic to some degree, but it has to come from somewhere. And you did the work. And the other comment I want to make about your drum teacher is that's so fantastic that he referred you one of your pivotal gigs that moved you forward.
Yeah.
So I can't think of a better testimonial to go out and study with someone, because
that's right.
A teacher can't do all the gigs that they get asked to do. And so who are they going to refer it to? They're going to refer it to their better students. So
yeah, it's really true.
Yeah. You know, Stevie, you were talking about going through these books and learning these fundamentals. I love what you said about having that prepared you, but you also nonchalantly said, you know, it was just word of mouth, people calling on your way up in the drum industry. But what I'd like to point out is that I bet you were prepared for those auditions. I bet you showed up on time. I bet you were somebody, you know, somewhat agreeable with the people you were working with, or you wouldn't have got those calls.
You know, that's a great point. It's a package, because there's so many, there's a lot of amazing players out there. I think it boils down to reliability, you know, especially with an artist. They want to feel comfortable with that, who's back there. They don't want to be worrying about that. Number one, got to be on time, like you said, easy to get along with. Yeah, I think somebody that might not be like as smoking as some other guy that is unreliable, they'll get the gig first, because like, you know what, it's a great hang.
Yeah. You gotta, for the time you're on the road, you gotta live with the guy or the girl. I mean, you're in very tight quarters, you know?
Yeah.
And you've got to live with them. That's a big thing. And it's something that pretty much everybody that comes on the show, it's the same thing. You know, they say the same thing.
Yeah, that's a great question.
I want to take a station identification break and say hi to Simon Paul from Switzerland, who's watching right now. Thank you for watching. And also a hi to Chris Brady, who says, Brother Stevie.
Hey, Brother Chrissy. Hey, and you know what, you guys? You know who the best kept secret is in Orange County?
Yes.
He plays like Vinny. He can play like Beccaro. He plays like Carmen Appice and Peter Chris all in one. It's our boy, Chris Brady.
Chris Brady.
Yeah.
That's right.
Chris Brady.
He's a bad boy, man. That cat can play. Boy, can he play.
And he can play and he can transcribe.
Oh, my gosh. Like,
you know what? If I have a question on a chart, I've done it many times. Chris, read this for me. No, you're wrong here. You're wrong here. All the time. He's fantastic.
He's brilliant, fantastic. Brilliant, talented cat.
Thank you guys for watching.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, now back to our regularly scheduled program.
Stevie, there's a video up on YouTube of you playing in Pompeii with David Gilmour, playing Comfortably Numb. And check that out, people. Can you tell us a little bit more about playing with David Gilmour, how you got that gig and that experience?
Yeah, that was...
And how did you prepare for that? How did you prepare for that?
It came out of left field, man. I haven't mentioned it, but I was with David Crosby since 98, and we were in a band called CPR with Jeff Pivar and James Raymond, who is a son who I met in college, that's a whole nother story. But we had this band, and then that kind of went into David and Graham Nash made a bunch of records together, and those guys wanted to tour Europe. So James calls me and says, hey, those guys want to tour Europe. They want to have you play. And they got Dean Parks on guitar and Andrew Ford on bass and myself. So we went to Europe. My first time playing that book, because that's different than Crosby's book, and it's different than Crosby, Stills, and Nash. It's like they had their own couple record, Wind on the Water and all that beautiful stuff, just the two of them. So I was lucky enough to get that gig, and we went to Europe and toured Europe. And when we were in England, we played at the Royal Festival Hall. And I joked about it. Remember we talked about it in the other interview where I changed out my heads that day? And I think, I don't know if you remember that, but I was like, I changed out my heads. The drum sounded really great. And, you know, I was kind of nervous because it was London and, you know, so, but that show went really, really well. And after the show, David Gilmour was at the show and John Paul Jones and a bunch of local, great.
No pressure.
You know, the London cat.
John Paul Jones. That doesn't happen. Sorry.
It was weird.
That just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
It was great. And it happened to be a good show. It just was good. Everything clicked. There were some funny bits in there too, because Crosby, I remember Crosby goes on and he introduced half the band. He introduced me. He says, yeah, Stevie's been my drummer for whatever. You know, we're buddies. Love having him. And no, he didn't call me Stevie. He called me Richard by accident. He goes, Richard DeStanislow. And everybody laughed. And then the band's like, and then Graham gets on the mic, goes, Richard. And then turned into this whole like comedy routine. So that was kind of funny because it kind of showed this human element of the band, whatever. But I just thought it was a funny moment. But anyway, fast forward. That was a crazy year. When I was in Europe, I don't want to bore you guys with this stuff, but when I was in Europe, I get an email from a friend of mine saying, hey, Loggins and Messina are holding auditions for a reunion tour. And I said, well, I'm in Europe right now, Crosby, Nash. I said, when are you going to be back? So anyway, I went home. I booked a audition for that, and luckily I got that gig, which was out of left field as well. I'm on tour with Loggins and Messina over the summer. So anyway, David Gilmour was at the tour at that show and saw me play. So now it's summertime. I'm with Loggins and Messina, and Crosby calls and says, David Gilmour is trying to get a hold of you for something. And I didn't believe him. And so finally I got a hold of him, and he asked if I'd like to tour with him. And I was like, what, huh? What? You know, it's surreal, you know? And, you only heard me play one night, one time. I mean, I could have had thank goodness that we had a decent show. So, of course I said yes. And then I went over there the following year to rehearse, and that was cool. That was in 2006. So we did that tour. And then I played with them subsequently after that on a bunch of TV shows, and we did some jams. And then in 2015, he did another tour. And then luckily I got asked to do that one too. And then, Pompeii, we wound up in Pompeii in 2016. But David, what a great guy. Not only just an amazing musician, but just the nicest guy, and knows what he wants. And, you know, kind of, it was nice. It was really, really great experience. I can't. You know, think of anything.
That's awesome. There's a link in the comments to that video from Pompeii.
Good.
And Jim Royal says your drumming on She's Got to Be Somewhere is wonderful. Such a great track. Steely Danish.
Yes. Oh, thanks. That was written by James Raymond, who's Crosby, David's son. Yeah. Really fun.
Hello, Josh Posey. Thanks for watching.
Yeah, everybody's watching today. As soon as I announced that you were going to be on here, I started getting like, you talk about everybody loving Chris Brady. Everybody loves Stevie. I started getting messages and texts. Ask him about this. Ask him about that. Talk about this. Talk about that. I know the story, and it's one of my favorite stories, the Division Bell, the Hammer. You got to tell the story about that. And when you bonked your head, tell the whole story about the bell. So there's a picture of it on our Facebook.
There we go. So there's a tune called High Hopes, and it's in the key of E. I don't know. But anyway, David had a Foundry bell made that's like literally this thick. Giant Foundry bell that's on this giant stand, and I remember trying to figure out where to put that thing. But you have to play with this hammer on off beats, and the keyboards on the down beats. But it's just a weird tune. But I bonked my head on that thing so many times. Just clocked my head. Like I'd reach down for something, bam, hit my head. But we were at the Albert Hall. Oh, so we went through all these different hammers to try to get the right sound. These plastic and none of it works. So we finally found this little hammer by drum tech, Simon Perks from Switzerland. Hi, Simon. He had these little hammers that were about that big. So they're easy to manage. And they had a square. It was like it was a little carpenter, like a cobbler's hammer. And he ended up putting leather on it, bound leather on there. And it got the perfect attack, didn't dent the bell. And it took forever to find that hammer. So we were playing the Albert Hall. I think we played a couple nights there, and I get back the next day and there's no hammer. And I'm like, did you take my hammer? What happened to the hammer? Somebody nicked the hammer. So, oh, and I know that sounds weird, but I couldn't get the right sound after that. And also the weight of the thing was perfect. So that was a little bit of a bummer. So somebody out there has that hammer.
Somebody's sitting at home right now going, I've got Stevie D's hammer and I stole it from the David Gilmour.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
It's up on eBay for $5,000 now.
Yeah, right.
So yeah. So that hammer situation, but that tune was challenging. Cause that tune, like I said, I started with offbeat. So the audience thinks it's the downbeat. Check it out. It's called High Hopes. And then you go when it kind of goes to this orchestral part where you're doing a lot of rolls and things like that, and then just goes to time and then back to the bell. So that was tricky. I had to put that down, So yeah. But anyway, David Gilmour, yeah, class act, one of the greatest. And so not only great musician, but just a great guy.
Yeah. And I gotta throw this out there because I think that somebody listening to this is probably wondering, when you get a guy like David Gilmour and you're going to play a catalog from Pink Floyd or songs from Pink Floyd, and isn't Dark Side of the Moon the biggest selling album of all times? Or it is, right?
Yeah,
it's one of the biggest selling albums of all times. It was on Billboard's thing for longer than any other record.
Yeah,
holds all these world records and unbelievable hits. How do you prepare for that, Stevie? How do you get ready for that kind of catalog, playing with the artist and doing the parts justice? Nick Mason, how did you do that? What did you do?
Well, ironically enough, interestingly enough, I never really got a set list or anything when I first got the gig. Usually get a tape and charts or whatever. There was nothing. And I didn't want to be like writing them going, hey man, what tunes are we doing? So I kind of did my own research. I went, okay, what songs did David Gilmour write? What's his solo material? What songs did he sing, most importantly? Mm-hmm. Because obviously he's going to do those. So I just made CDs, and I just used to drive. I drove around in my car and just listened to them for like 6 months. I didn't write charts or anything. Oh, that's the other thing real quick. So I used to write charts and for some of these gigs. And one thing I learned is that some of these artists change their mind or change the arrangement on the fly. Like Kenny Loggins was really notorious for that. So if you write a chart out and you're reading bars and not everyone has the same chart, let's say you do your own notes. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Right.
It can hurt because then you're lost because you're going, well, I'm at bar 104. And they're like, what's that? What? So one thing I learned was that for myself personally, since I sang, I went, oh, what if I wrote all the lyrics out and wrote in between the margins? That way I'm reading like in other words, so that I'd write, instead of writing a full chart out with bars, like I said, I'd write the lyric. Tempo is, 84 or whatever. There's a fill that goes into it, two bar rest, whatever, little notes like that, and then just learn the tune. And then, so that way, if you're in rehearsal, they go, well, we don't do that anymore. We added like 16 bars, or we only do this weird phrase thing. So you can write that in the margins and you're not stuck with the chart. You're not stuck with bars. That really saved me.
So sort of like, here's the lyrics of the verse, and then, well, here's the beat that I play on the verse.
That's correct, yes. And then,
chorus beat, do a fill went before the chorus.
That's right. And that way you're flexible enough that if they change something, if it gets changed in the rehearsal, you can make your note without, being lost. And so that helped me a lot. Anyway, so I did that, and I did those kind of notes. So he'd call the tune, and then I'd have the lyrics there. And it was kind of, I didn't feel like it was cheating. Cause like, well, I'm going to sing some of these backgrounds. I might as well know what the lyrics are. So that was kind of, and that really has carried into what I do today. I mean, even that's really been a great method to do it. It's a great way to learn the song, number one.
Right.
And it keeps you free from, wait a minute. I thought we were going to do this at bar. Oh, you don't have charts either. Oh, sorry. It's one way to do it, but that's worked for me. But that's how I learned the music. I just listened to it a lot. I didn't actually sit down and even really practice it. Like, I just listened and listened and listened and absorbed it and didn't think about it. Just listened. And, yeah. and it just kind of seeped into my consciousness, kind of, you know, like, you know, you guys know, you guys, yeah. you guys heard these tunes and you go do a gig and you go, I know this tune because I've heard it a million times. It's in your DNA. You know what to do. You know what I mean? It just plays itself, kind of.
Yeah. So, exactly.
I found the video with the hammer. It's posted in the chat. I hope.
Nice.
I hope. Cool. Yeah.
Hey, Stevie. So, did you have with Gilmour? Did you have a little wiggle room to play it your way, or did you have to really try to copy?
He didn't. No, he didn't want it note for note. Like he wanted. Obviously, you got to play that in the spirit of it, and you know, you don't want to be subdividing 16th notes uncomfortably. No, da 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 da. You know, it would change the whole feel. You know, you got to obviously play the feel. Yeah. But no, he was cool about that. Like,
that's nice.
I didn't have to play Phil's note for note. As a matter of fact, you know, some of the fans, I think, were commenting in a negative way that he's not playing exactly the Rototom solo from Time.
That's what I was just going to ask you about.
Because, first of all, Nick had like, they had like 12 tones in the studio, or either they had six, they had eight and eight. I don't know. They had a ton of Rototoms and they're all tuned chromatically.
Yeah.
So he created that there. Well, I had four of them.
Yeah.
And you can only do so much with four tones. So I even said, I mean, I couldn't have played it note for note anyway, because I didn't have the dozen or whatever they needed.
Yeah.
But I did take a little heat for that. People are like, he's not playing the Time solo even close. But I didn't play it like a drum solo. I played it in the same. That's one thing I did write out note for note. I wrote
you
out
did.
Six. Yes. So I try to at least get the rhythms right.
Yeah.
You know, because he does some cool, the way he did his, it's really angular. So I have a chart for that. I wrote that out note for note, but I get away from it. So to answer your question, I had some leeway there. Yeah. There was some freedom there, you know, and that's one cool thing about like Crosby too. He wanted you to be you. He was like, I want, you know, you guys, you know, yeah, we got to play the song a certain way, but express yourself. He goes, I want this to be a band. And that's the cool thing about, you know, those artists is that they're from that school of, you know, casting. You cast the right, it's like being a producer. You cast the right players for your song. You let them do their thing and they're going to bring what they bring to it. And it's going to be better than you know, I could have ever imagined or whatever. Or different anyway, but
you got to be you. You didn't have to be somebody else
for the most part. But at the same time, you have to honor that feel. Otherwise, it doesn't. Just music doesn't work. You know.
Oh yeah.
But
yeah.
Note for note, I listen to the original stuff, and there's little things like we did Run Like Hell, and I put some of my own fills in there. Just simple little pickup stuff that I it's not exactly like the record, you know.
Right.
So
hey, what shout about? Out to the Remo Rototom, man.
You got him, man. You're ready, right? Breck, you're ready to go, man.
Oh hell yeah.
You got it. You got it together. Look at that kit. That's awesome, man.
Stevie, I have a
dude, his whole studio is awesome, man.
That's
his
so cool.
Studio's
I know, look
killer.
At that.
It should be a playground. It should be a fun place.
Yeah, man.
To come
I'm gonna come down and take a lesson, dude.
Come on over, man.
I'm coming.
We'll hang out. That would be
I will.
Amazing. I'll take a lesson from you.
Nah, man.
That'd be fun. I'm just out in San Diego. Come on over.
I will. That'd be fun.
Hey, I have a quick gear geek question for you about that Pompeii show.
Okay.
Your front bass drum head had a double vent. So can you tell us about that?
You know, I thought it looked cool. No, I
thought it looked cool.
I think it was because there were two. I don't know. I think it was. I don't know why that happened. To be honest with you, I don't know. I think it was maybe two microphones or easier access or something. But yeah, I really don't remember exactly why we did that. Yeah. But I thought it looked pretty cool anyway.
You know, I could hear the kick over the volcanoes.
Oh. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I'm sorry. I can't answer that question. I don't remember. I don't remember why we double ported that. Maybe because the mics must have been the mic situation. Yeah. you know, but
Simon just posted, he said it to get the second microphone in it.
Oh, okay, there you go. Simon's on right now?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's
Simon. Awesome. You're the man. Yeah, buddy.
On, love it. What about, like, okay, we've talked a lot about Gilmore. Any of the artists that you've worked with, are they really picky about your drum tones and your drum sounds? Hey, that snare is not quite right. Or, you know, does anybody ever, has they ever given you a hard time about it? Or, hey, that's great. What's that like?
Not so much the artist, but the engineer obviously will have his we'll have a conversation about that. Like,
okay.
For Crosby, Stills, and Nash, actually I learned a lot from my drum tech, Kevin O'Connor, cause he's a great drummer in his own right. But anyway, he was really good at tuning. I would tend to tune my toms a little lower, fatter, mm-hmm. and he tuned them way up. And at first I was like, this feels weird. But he was onto something, because they projected more live.
Yeah.
Like John Bonham, his stuff was pitched up pretty high.
Yeah, he cranked his bass drum head.
Yeah. And I'd never really thought of it like that for live. It translated better out front. So he, in that sense, I learned a lot from Kevin, and accepted that a little more, as far as like, okay, I'm good with tuning these up. They felt a little boingy to me because they were higher pitched. And I love playing higher pitched drums, especially when I play jazz stuff. I like, a little higher tuned, but we all like that fat, fat, fat,
yeah,
tom sound. But yeah. Not really any artist. They really never real that particular about that. We try to get the drums to sound the best I could, you know, for my ears. And fortunately, it seemed like it was okay. And again, I had amazing drum techs that took care of everything, and Simon tuned the drums immaculately. And anyway.
Very cool. What about playing to a click? Because I would think that a lot of the stuff that you're doing, you're playing to a click. Were you on the click with the Gilmore Show or the Crosby Show or any of them?
No click. Well, so for like David Crosby's gig or Crosby, Nash, Crosby, Stills, Nash, I never played to a click. We didn't have any pre-records, which is awesome, which is rare these days.
Right.
So I'd have a metronome, and I would reference my tempos, and then I'd count the band in based on that. Maybe keep it in for a minute just to see if I'm on track, and then bail on it. Most of the time that's what was the case. Same with David Gilmore's gig, reference to metronome if I had to count the tune off. There were a couple tunes that there were only a couple tunes because there were maybe strings they needed to fly in or whatever that could comfortably numb at the beginning, right. If you didn't play with the orchestra. So yeah, I'd say, and then there's other gigs that it was a full, the whole night was click. So I obviously prefer not playing to one, just because I like speed. I like breathing, no pun intended, you know, it's leading four. And, but also there's a way to do that. Obviously you guys know, you guys play the clicks where you can give it life by, you know, playing ahead of it or playing behind it, you know, all this stuff. You know, those are definitely techniques to learn. And I'm still learning that, you know, I'm still working on that part.
Right. Hey guys, you know, we're talking about that bass drum with the two vents. The Chris Brady said we ported that at my place at Aquarian Drumhead. So
that's right. Yep. Ah. Chris Brady is my man.
He was over there. He was over there with his X-Acto knife, probably porting.
Chris is so. I kind of look kind of fun, you know.
So yeah. Stevie, what are you doing now? What's going on now in your career? What are you working on or focused on?
I for a long time have been interested in producing. I know a lot of people get into it. I know Bart's doing that as well. So I'm spending a lot of my time taking on projects here at my studio and writing. And I feel like I'm mentoring some of these clients I have to create these songs. And also I'm a singer. So this one particular client is taking vocal lessons. He's a graphic designer. His name is John Lynch. Great writer.
Right on.
He came to me, and I'm So I got him in the real world. We're working on vocals. I'm kind of coaching him here. He's taking his lessons. And so I've been doing a lot of that. And when COVID hit, like the rest of us, we had to kind of work out of our studio. So I must have done 40, 50 drum tracks for people.
Wow.
And awesome.
I did work with Tim Finn and Phil Manzanera. I did some stuff for them. A bunch of this, a local, this guy's name, Louis Lindell up in Santa Barbara. He's must have done 4 albums. And he sends me, I record it and send them back to him. And then we have that kind of relationship. So I've been doing a lot of stuff here and I love it. It's creative. I can help people. And I feel like, it's kind of my own hours and I can sleep in my own bed, which is nice. I'm doing a lot of that right now. And I'm writing a lot. And I also started a company with a friend of mine called Storyline Songs, Scott Pasalia, and we're doing sync licensing. And we're going to be also doing custom songwriting for people. That's a whole nother side of it. So I'm loving the songwriting thing, getting more into that side and overseeing production. I just finished a 12 tune album for this guy named Ross Gearhart. And we did everything from a boogie shuffle to I did a Strauss waltz with the full orchestra I arranged.
Wow.
So, and everything in between. And so, man, I've been really loving that. And got a nice. New puppy. We got a new puppy, my girlfriend and I. So nice. That's been great. I'm like, I'm a stay at home dad kind of. And so that's been really great. Also, this organization called Angel Force. I just came aboard last year. Yeah. Angel Force. And it's an assembly of great musicians that have played with a lot of great acts, from Jim Cregan, who wrote a lot of hits for Rod Stewart. They actually started it. His band would come over and do these events for Ann Dunsmore. And this is to raise awareness for veteran suicide, which is an epidemic. So it's called Angel Force USA.
I'll put that in the link in the comments.
Thank you. Thank you. And so Frank Symes from The Who is in the band playing guitar. He's the musical director. James Raymond's aboard now. We got Jen Oberle. We got the guys from Sugar Ray. Pawn Shop Kings. It's really fun. Great hang. And we go do these events and it's a lot. We have a lot of good stuff coming up too. We're going to be going to DC next month for the Vietnam Week. And we're going to be playing at near the Washington Monument. So those are really great things. So I got to play live. So that's been really great. I have a jazz quintet called Solar Flare. Mm-hmm. And that's really near to my heart. So I'm writing a new album for that as well. So I'm looking at
how many do you have now?
I
have it. It's fantastic.
Oh, thanks.
Well, we came and saw you on the album release. Remember that?
The
brewery thing.
The brewery, yeah.
Dude, that was fantastic, man. Oh, that was such a great band. Man.
Thanks.
That's a fantastic album.
Thanks. That really was fun. That was one of those things where, I knew I was going to do a lot of touring in 2016. And I was like, man, I used to play in this band called ESP. And it was a jazz quartet. And that's all I did for like 3-4 years when I wasn't on the road. It was like, I lived this band and I really missed it. I missed those guys. So I called him up and said, hey, do you want to get together and have a play? And this beginning of the year. And I also played with a guitar player named Carl Verheyen for many years. Mm-hmm. Carl played in Supertramp. He's a number one session guitarist monster. So I called Carl. I go, hey man, remember we were talking about doing some jazz? Well, do you want to come and play with us? And so I booked a studio on a Saturday. We went to Simon Phillips studio, his old studio that was in Phantom, that was in Van Nuys. We did 4 or 5 tunes live. And we kind of joked at lunch and said, why don't we do four more tunes and make an album out of it? And we did. So it's a great band. It's Paul Carman, Mark Massey, Kevin Axt on bass, and Carl and myself. And that's really something that's dear to my heart. So I'm hoping to do more of that.
That's
kind
awesome.
Of like a little juggling act going on.
That's
right,
cool.
So cool. So yeah. Cool. Awesome. You said at the beginning of the show, and we're getting close to the end, and I don't mean to jump backwards.
No.
You'd mentioned Garibaldi, that
yes.
you had done some work with Garibaldi or studied with him or something.
Right.
Talk to us about the Garibaldi situation with you and him, please.
Sure. I was about early 20s, and a friend of mine, Brian DeMille, was taking from him. And I was kind of looking to take some lessons, you know, from, I took one from a couple from Ralph Humphrey. I went to Chuck Flores and he goes, "Hey, I'm studying with David Garibaldi. Are you kidding me? He's teaching? You gotta be kidding me. Great." He goes, I go, "Do you think he would take me on as a student?" He said, "Yeah, here, I'll give you his number." So I called him up and he was just great. So I went up to, I think he was living in, gosh, Calabasas or something like that. Okay. And I went up there and I remember I was so nervous. And he goes, "Okay, go in the room. There's the drums in there." Anyway, I sat down. I was so nervous, like, and he comes in, he goes, "What's the matter?" I said, I can't play. So I think he went back and left the room and I started playing. He comes back, because I knew you could play. Yeah, you know, because I kind of loosened up. But anyway, you're a sweetheart of a guy. And what he goes, "So this is what I do. I take a beat and I shift it over and do the permutation." He was talking about the permutation stuff. Because I was like, "Show me Soul Vaccination from Tower Power, or, you know, what is hip?" Because, let's not do that. Let's do this. So he kind of showed me his formula of how he creates beats. You know, he'll take a beat and then he'll shift it over 16th, you know, until you have 16 more beats. Or if it's a triplet, obviously you'll have 12 more beats out of that. But the coolest thing about the lessons, he didn't really get into technique with me. He didn't really get into, you know, posture and any of that stuff. Because he thought, "Yeah, you got that pretty much together. It looks pretty comfortable." But he programmed a drum machine which had percussion on it. And once you started permutating those beats, it with the percussion shifting, all of a sudden it's a whole nother world. So I really got a lot out of that, because he said, "So your lesson for next time is come up with 10 of your own ideas. That's your lesson." Because you know, wow, that's the concept. Well, he gave me a sheet, of course, with his stuff. And then he goes, "Create your own." I came back in with my own. And after that, he was like, "I think you got it. Just keep making up your own stuff." That was it. So I took two lessons from him. And but those two lessons really, one thing, it really drove the work. It was working with a click, but it was percussion. And that really helped my time a lot. Because I started, he goes, "Program some percussion stuff, play with that. And then work on your, and it'll really open up your mind." Because if you have a conga pattern going and then you shift it over, all of a sudden it's in a different spot, then it's in another spot, then it's in another, you know. And I really dug the triplet stuff, like the 12-8. That got into some really interesting beats, you know.
So, that's cool, man. Yeah, that's really hip.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, what is hip?
What is hip? Hey, come on, Rick. Where's my rim shot?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
sorry,
you missed it, dude. You missed it.
Oh man.
Ouch, man.
Stevie, so are you getting time now to practice?
Yeah, you know, I'm getting kind of back into that. We were just talking about that. Like Chip and I were talking about that. He's getting into it again and kind of looking at some new things to work on. Yeah. Mainly my feet right now. I actually added another pedal, so I'm doing a double pedal thing, which I never did.
Oh, really? You're playing double bass?
Yeah. Well, not double bass, but double pedal. Because I never really, I always been a single pedal player. But I'm finding like there's all kind of different things you can do with the left foot other than the hi-hat, you know?
Yeah.
Even just playing quarter notes at a super soft volume, because I don't know about you guys, but I can control my left foot. It's a different, obviously different muscles.
Right.
You know, I can't go da-da-da-da with my left foot, but I can with my right. But my left foot has different kind of control. So just to go boop, 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 it's easier to do with my left foot that soft. If you have to play a little
bit. Oh, just like feathering the kick drum.
Yeah, it's weird. Oh, okay. It's like, it's just because I'm just so used to that on the
quarter note.
Hi-hat. But yeah, I'm getting into that more. And I'm just kind of sitting down and, you know, and just experimenting more and just having a chance to just kind of, you know, just kind of explore.
Hey, Stevie, what is your setup right now? Can you give us a gear rundown?
As far as the studio here?
No, as far as your drum set, like what kind of drums and stuff are you doing?
Well, I'm in the studio right here. I have I bought a club custom kit because I thought they looked pretty cool.
Yeah.
But I have a bunch of DW drums too, and which I play live. But I have this kit here. And so basically playing a 22 by 15 bass drum, a 10, 12, 16. And then I've got Paiste cymbals. So it's a basic set. It's like a 5-piece set.
Nice.
And then I switch out the snares for whatever recording. I just did this guy's, you know, John Lynch's tune, and this club custom snare that came with the kit. Brilliant. And nice. I dampen it down. So I said, that real fat thing. So that's what I'm using right now. I got I'll use the 602 and the Masters Ride Paistes. I'm a Paiste guy. I've been Paiste guy for since 92.
So's Chip.
There you go, Chip.
Yeah, baby.
There you go.
Paiste, yeah. I just love them. They're just so musical.
Yeah, they are.
And some of my favorite cymbals I got in actually the used bin over there in Brea. I got flat 602 flat rides, and I have Soundform. When Rich Mangiacaro was working there, when he was the artist rep there, he's actually the one who pulled me in. He hooked me up with their Sound Formula, and they discontinued them. So I have a 20-inch ride. That's what I used on David Gilmour's gig. That 20-inch Sound Formula, that this has a thing. And the high hats that came with it. So those are cool. So yeah, it's kind of a basic set.
What kind of heads and sticks are you on?
I'm using Aquarian heads, of course.
Aquarian.
Mainly texture coated on top, and clear classic clears on the bottom. Sometimes for the some of the other kits, I use the Response 2 clear. Mm-hmm. And I think they sound really great. And also the snare heads I love are the modern or American vintage heads.
That's what I have right here. I have a modern vintage too right here.
So this is something kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Is I know we're running out of time here, but one thing I remember with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, David Crosby, was I was using the modern vintage heads, and I broke a snare. I ran out of heads or something, and I had of those heads, and I had the texture coateds in my case. So I changed it out. Kevin Madigan comes up, the front of house guy. He's like, what do you do to your snare drum? I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, it sounds totally different today. I said, well, I changed the head out. He goes, it doesn't sound as good. Not that it didn't sound bad. It sounded bad, but he goes, what heads were you using? I said, well, I had this modern vintage. For some reason, he thought they had more snap.
Really?
It was weird. Yeah. I mean, the same drum, the same mic. Not, you know, the texture coatings work for me all the time, but for some reason, I don't know if it's the coating. Chris would tell you, but Kevin Madigan was like, no, call them up, get those heads put back on, because it completely changed the sound of that snare room. Which is
it
weird.
Does. Yeah, I did a gig the other night, and I took my 6-inch Superphonic, and it had a modern vintage on it. And just for the gig, real quick, I'm going to change it out. Took the head off, and I put a Focus X on it, which the Focus X is more of a dampened head, but it is surprising.
Focus X.
It is, dude. That's a fantastic snare head, but it did. It's unbelievable the difference. You know,
really? I need to try that one. Yeah,
it just got a little ring underneath it, you know, and it dampens the head a little bit.
All those heads are great. I mean, they stay in tune. They're easy to tune, and they sound phenomenal. And then I play Vic Firth sticks. I've been playing with those forever. I love those sticks. And so,
Me too, right there.
Yeah. Okay. Those modern vintage, by the way, are amazing on toms.
Oh, yeah.
And I have a modern vintage on the front of my kick head.
Oh, no kidding.
And that... it warms it up. It just sounds really good.
Yeah, it's warm. I love those heads, and awesome.
It's just so fun to experiment, and that's the whole point of everything that we're all doing. We're all just experimenting with our music and our gear, and we appreciate you coming on here, Stevie. Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate it. You guys are great,
I'm going to ask the most important question of the day. And we always save this one for last. And since you're like kind of over in the Tustin Newport area, I'm going to make this more of a worldwide question. This is super important. Okay. Every drummer wants to know the answer to this question. Where do you get the best pizza?
Mama de Stanislaus down the street. My mom.
There you go.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mama de Stanislaus. I can't really, other than Italy, you know, people, let's go to an Italian restaurant. I'm like, between my sister and my mom, they make the best Italian food ever. So it's like spoiled.
I bet, man. I bet. Yeah. Had to ask. Right, we ask everybody that. So awesome, Stevie. Dude, it's great to see you, bud. It's great really good to see you.
Yeah, it's great meeting you guys and seeing you. And I'm a fan of all you guys. And, you know, keep it up. Keep up the great work. You know,
well, we're fans of you. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks
for being on the show. Thank you so much. Right. Okay, guys, everybody have a fantastic week. Next week, we have no idea what we're doing. We're shooting from the hip, but we're going to have a lot of fun doing it. Everybody have a great week. Stevie, thank you for coming on. Now go practice. Go practice. See you guys. I'm no chip ritter.